Okay.
It's really good to be here today with Lester Rappaport. Lester is an artist, and he contacted me and said that we should talk. So, Lester, I'm going to start by asking you, well, eventually I want you to tell me your story, but I'm going to start by asking you why it was you contacted me. And then you said you had some questions for me, so we'll just see where it goes.
Okay, so back in 2019, a studio assistant said I should watch John Verbeke's Awakening from the Meaning Crisis. And since that time, I have tried to really begin to absorb all of the extraordinary stuff that's going on what I think Verbeke calls his little corner of the internet, which is it's so stimulating, exciting, profound, awakening. And here you were, an artist, talking to Jordan Hall and Michael Levin. Michael Levin, I had actually seen, watched another couple of videos and was very much excited about what he had to say. And Jordan Hall, was a revelation on your show. So, and here you were, an artist, hosting both of them. So I thought, let me reach out. Artist, lover of this extraordinary, can we call it a renaissance? I don't know. The what's going on with these thinkers is so important and profound and enlightening or awakening. And here you are in the middle of it. So that's why I reached out to you.
Well, thank you. I feel like we are in the middle of something that's just it's an amazing time to be alive. Let's put it that way. It's an amazing time to be alive and to have been able to have been privileged to watch it as it happened, because I started on this back in 2017, and to just watch things unfolding, like you could see something coming, especially from listening to Jordan Peterson back in 2017. I felt something was coming, was going to come out of that. And then to watch the things arise. And to me, the really interesting thing is that so many of the people like Jordan Peterson and John Verbeke and others come from Toronto. So it's as though something got seeded in Toronto and then started moving out into the world.
By the way, I lived in Toronto in 1969, on and off until 1975.
Well, there you go. See,
I
there's something about Toronto.
had, I there was a gallery there by the name of the David Mirvish Gallery. The backstory of that is that his father was a big deal in Toronto. He had this department store, and he had theaters and restaurants and real estate. And he had this strip where a lot of artists had rented studio space. And his son, David, decided not to go to college, but to become an art dealer. And David had this brownstone that had, he became a, an acolyte, I guess, of Clement Greenberg. And I walked into his gallery, and there was a Jules Olitski spray painting, and I had never heard of Jules Olitski. And there was a Motherwell Open Series painting, and like he hired me to be part of his ground crew, and I helped knock down the back end of the brownstone, and he built this spectacular gallery. And I got the privilege of helping hang shows, and whenever they needed anybody for art, they would call me, and I got to see great Morris Louis's and Kenneth Nolan's and Jules Olitski's and Ron Davis, who never really became a big deal, but I loved Milton, Marvin Motherwell. It was like the key to how I spread my wings and started becoming at least well versed in stuff that I really enjoyed. And his gallery was the go-to place for anybody on North American continent to come to buy that kind of Washington School color field painting. Frankenthaler was in, it was an extraordinary time. And I was so fortunate to have walked into it. And it was like a turning point. So that was from
So all of that was happening in Toronto.
That was Toronto.
Yeah, that is extraordinary. I love Milton Avery. I've seen some original Frankenthalers, so yeah, I'm familiar with most of those people. Some of them that you mentioned, I haven't heard of. The Zelitsky,
Jules Zelitsky. He's less on the radar now, but interestingly enough, back in 1968, 69, I was working for a contractor while I was going to graduate school at Hunter College. And he had me use an industrial spray gun to seal some plywood. And that got me to starting to do some pastels where I put the pastel on the paper and then take tissue to kind of make it very vaporized like.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anybody was using spray guns. And here I walked into the David Marish Gallery and had this big sprayed canvas. Mm-hmm. And he had a very powerful reputation at the time. And he did some absolutely gorgeous spray paintings.
Mm-hmm.
He moved on to do lots of other things. But that's Jules Olitsky.
What, years ago, one of the fun things that I used to do is take photographic paper and paint on it with acrylic ink. And then while it was still damp, spray it with clear acrylic.
Mm.
Just watch what would happen. It's very exciting.
You know, one of the amazing things that maybe we'll have time to talk about the paradigm, the new paradigm of modern art that began to really start to form in the 1860s, is our adventure into materials, an act of discovery of seeing what we can do to find new and unusual ways to express ourselves. And you're doing that with photographic papers, and is a wonderful example of that. You know, it's like we weren't if we wanted to be artists, we didn't have a predetermined, this is a skill set that you have to use in order to do what you're going to do to make a statement. We actually began to find our own unique ways of creating craft that also is self-expressive. And you doing that is a perfect example of it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that I never settled on a style that is recognizably my style, because I'm always thinking of something new that I could be doing. Maybe I'm ADHD or something. So everything is new and different. And I can't, there have been times when I've painted something and I've loved it so much. I've said, oh, this is it. This is going to be my style. But then some other idea will pop into my head and I'll think, yeah, but what if I did this? And then I'm off and running on something else.
Well, you know, the small painting, I think it's a painting that you posted on Instagram that landscape with the sun and those warm reds and yellows, if I'm remembering correct, you just posted it a couple of days ago, that was sold. It reminded me of kind of the warmth and mystery of an Odéon Redon painting. So I'm wondering.
Oh,
whether...
he was definitely one of my inspirations. I love okay. his work. Yes, 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 yes. And also one of his contemporaries, Delacroix.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I love Delacroix's use of color very much. So, yeah. Well, so you had some questions.
Well, you started to answer them. Okay. I snuck them in. I wanted to know some of who your inspirations were.
Well, I started out in watercolor, just taking a community class and trying to learn how to paint some pictures for my own house, because we had moved into a house that had a lot of empty walls. And I liked going to art fairs and seeing pretty little watercolors, and I couldn't afford to buy them. So I thought, well, I'll paint some, because I very naively thought it's got to be easy, right? I was 50 years old at the time, and I thought, well, I'm 50 years old, I should be able to do anything. So then I found out very quickly that it's way more difficult even to do a simple little watercolor. So over time, I decided that I would persevere in spite of my ineptitude. And eventually I got to where I started taking workshops with pretty well-known watercolor artists, studying with them for a week at a time and trying desperately not to end up looking like them. You know, I mean, that's one of the challenges of studying under other people, is people can come in and they can say, oh, she studied under so-and-so. And so I was trying to develop my own process. And then I decided that, well, here was a turning point for me, because I was participating in a show. Actually, I was not participating. I was asked to hang a show that was one of these shows where it was a multimedia show. They had a watercolor section, an acrylic section, an oil section, and then they had judges from each field come in and judge the works, and then there were going to be monetary prizes. And I was part of the hanging crew. So I was there, and the judge came in judging the watercolor section. And there were some beautiful works in there, beautiful abstract works that I just thought were amazing. He just walked right past all of them to this little landscape boat scene of some village. And he said, now this is a quality watercolor. And I thought, he's not judging the art. He's judging some set of skills or some, you know, some pattern of working. And I didn't want to be associated with that, because I thought, I want my work to be judged on whether or not it's a work of art based on the quality of the work. So I decided to switch to acrylic, because there was a little more freedom in that field. And after working in acrylic for a while, I thought, gosh, there's got to be something easier than this. You know, watercolor gives you all these happy accidents.
Oh, yeah.
And so it leads you on this very adventurous path where you can explore lots of opportunities. But acrylic, if you use it in the traditional way, pretty much you have to be intentional about every single thing you do. And I'm not a very intentional person. So I was trying to develop a style of using acrylic that would give me that freedom. So then I thought, well, I'll try oil, because maybe oil is easier. And I started working with oil, and I found oil made me very, very traditional. I got super detailed, and, you know, so my oil work, I have some paintings that I love from that period, but they look more like, you know, just very traditional art.
It's fascinating.
Back to acrylic.
It's fascinating how the medium is part of how we actually express.
Yes.
Yeah. You think of it. Well, it's this cold, empty material, and you can do whatever you want with it. But there's you generate a dialogue with it and find how you can maneuver and manipulate so that you're doing something that you want to with it. But it's part of the process.
Well, and it is often not very cooperative. You want it to do a certain thing, and you have this vision, oh, I can make it do this thing, and not in a million years. And so this is why I like Marshall McLuhan when he talks about the medium is the message. Because you think, oh, I can
Toronto,
make this medium.
Toronto guy. Marshall McLuhan.
Another Toronto guy.
I think University of Toronto.
Yeah, there you go. So you would think I could do the same painting in oil or acrylic or watercolor and I could make it look exactly the same, but not in a million years. Because, and maybe it is that dialogue issue. You start with the thing in mind that you're going to make it do, and you probably could make it do that. But if you did, it would be very rigid and very, as you said before, not generative. It would just be very rigid without generating anything new. And so in order to let the medium lead you a little bit, you have to give up on being so directive and just find out what it does. And then that creates this dialogue back and forth. And
in my own evolution, I started being encouraged because my parents thought I had talent at age three. And my first love was drawing. And I blossomed with like life drawing and my move away from representational art happened because I could not paint the way I could draw. And I knew I had to use color and paint. I knew I had to do that. I knew I just couldn't draw. And so it was, do I give up the drawing so that I pursue abstract art? Or do I give up abstract art to just pursue drawing? And I gave up, essentially I stopped. One of the things that I found so engaging, which was life drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And the first abstract painting that I did after giving up, after making that decision, and I made that decision because my paintings were getting tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter mm-hmm. and tighter. So the first abstract painting I made was a 6-foot square mapped out like with a 2-foot square in the center, and the painting was gessoed white and the 2-foot square in the center was yellow. And I kind of said to myself, okay, this is my letter A, my beginning, as an abstract painter, my ground zero. This is my, you know, it's not like I was going to try and produce something mature at that time. It was, I'm starting from a beginning. And that was how I started mm-hmm. being an abstract painter.
Well, I noticed that a lot of your work, you're using the geometric shapes and you're using division of space as part of your vocabulary.
While I was in school, Clement Greenberg was like the big deal. And he was talking about painting being a flat surface that you put color on. And I never bought the flat surface.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite film one of my favorite films, but in a certain way, the most important creatively for me is 2001. Where there's this sense of the science fiction and the poetry of huge space. And I remember living in Toronto and painting my first relatively successful explorations in abstraction, and the word cosmic was always on my mind. Mm. it was just like that's. I mean, it wasn't filled out with anything because I didn't know what that meant, but the gem, the seed of it was always there. And this sense of always creating a two-dimensional surface which infers space is something that is there throughout everything I've done, I think.
Yeah,
and then
like, there's a lot yeah. behind that for sure. Yeah. Keep going. You said, and then.
And then in 1991, I started meditating. And I started meditating because I was working on these intuitive paintings that led me to say, now I'm going to meditate. It's like the painting told me to go sit. And I sat for half an hour. I had tried to meditate and I did some yoga, but it never took. And after painting this small acrylic painting on paper with plus with oil stick drawing, something clicked and I went in and I sat for half an hour. And pretty much I haven't missed a day since then. And what happened was I started going to a place in my meditation where I would get imagery. And I would go into the studio and do the imagery that I got from the meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much how I've evolved for since like that's like 33 years ago.
So it reminds me of Hilma af A.F. Klimt.
Off Klimt, yes,
yeah.
Yes, 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 yes. There's that whole strain of modern art that begins, abstract art, that begins with spiritual painters who have a spiritual connection to the world, beginning to paint abstractly as a way of expressing that spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
There's Malevich in Russia, there's Mondrian, there's Kandinsky, and there's Helmut Auf Klimt. And
mm-hmm.
Helmut Auf Klimt, who didn't show and only recently has been given the title of the first abstract painter retroactively, but she didn't influence me the way those other people did because she just wasn't on, she wasn't known. She wasn't
Right,
shown.
right. I
No
mean,
one
it's just
talked about
only
her.
very recently that her work was discovered,
Yeah.
really.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she made a decision not to show. I don't remember exactly why, but yeah.
Well, I think it was she was in conversation with Rudolf Steiner, and I think that he was maybe the one who encouraged her not to show it, but just to season it or to wait. I can't remember exactly what language he used.
Yeah, I think there may have been something that the world was, she thought the world wasn't ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Mondrian and Kandinsky were both connected to theosophy. And Malevich had, my memory is bad on this, but some connection to a cosmic kind of spiritual connection with painting his like black on black or black and white painting or, you know, so there was something spiritual there as well. So the foundations of abstract art were permeated with transcendent expression.
So when you think transcendent, how are you identifying that word?
As opposed to the, and I'm not, I'm very much a fan of secular humanism, but the way Wilbur talks about the flatland, the sense of there not being something larger, something more, like in Buddhist terms, awakening,
mm-hmm.
or in Christian terms, Christ consciousness, that there's a larger essence or something out there that is that we're attempting to express. So I think that's how I would talk about transcendence.
So you're when you paint, you feel like you're or at least when you meditate, you feel like you're listening for something from beyond or outside to guide you.
I don't know. To say that I think it's from the outside, I don't know. It's like it's
mm-hmm.
opening up to the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's. I mean, you do. Do I think? Do if I had to bet one way or the other whether there's something other than just being us here, I would
Mm-hmm.
say yes. But that's, you know, that's a hunch, an intuition.
Mm-hmm.
But when I meditate, I don't know where it's coming from. I mean, I did a series of paintings in the 80s where I think of them as like my heroic abstract phase. I was painting big pictures, and they were multi-layered and complex. And I tried to explain them one time to somebody by saying, I'm on a mountaintop, and I'm opening up to the cosmic forces coming through me, and they're going out. And like what you're, the individuality that you're seeing is my specific scrim of flesh and blood and experience, but that it was, you know, it's opening up. It's this total opening up too. So that's as good as explanation. And that's constantly how I think about it now. It's just, you know, I read an article recently about that posited hyperconsciousness, a fifth time space hyperconsciousness as a fifth dimension, that there's something out there that we can open up to and tap into. It made sense to me. I mean, how are you going to prove it? I don't know.
Well, have you listened to any of Stephen Wolfram's material?
I don't know.
He's a mathematician, physicist, brilliant thinker who's invented amazingly powerful internet engine for doing helping with mathematics, and it's called Mathematica. And a lot of physicists and mathematicians use this Mathematica engine all the time. But he also developed a concept which he's calling the new physics. So he's setting aside the current standard model of physics and trying to look at it from another perspective and saying, is there another way in which we can discern all the same physical laws that we already know about in the universe, but find them through a different avenue? And the avenue that he chose to pursue, and I mean, he's not saying this is true. He's just saying, this is an idea, and I'm going to pursue this idea. And the idea was that rather than space-time being a one thing, the way Einstein imagined it, space and time are two separate things. And space is not just a place to put things, but space is actually everything. So space is composed of particles that are much smaller than the smallest of the standard particles. And he calls those very small particles, he calls them eems, E-M-E-S. So if you can imagine all of space is all just gajillions of little particles. So, and time updates the particles where they are. The conformation of the particles is updated by time. So both time and space are quantified, very small. Well,
there's a relationship, but they're each separate in a way.
That's right. There is a definite relationship. And the particles start out with one. Originally, when he conceived this, he thought, what if there is a rule that tells the particles how to separate and move? And what would happen if you did that? So he started out with a very simple rule that looks like one particle that then becomes three particles. And then each of those, this new shape can modify into other shapes with the updating of time. So he started running this on computers and found that it makes all these fascinating shapes. Actually, I'm going to put it on pause and bring up his website to show this to you, because I think you'll enjoy this. Okay, so I found this. I'm going to share a screen for you, and we will see what this looks like. You can see this, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so up in the upper left-hand corner is the rule, the first rule.
Uh-huh.
And so you have one node, and it moves out to two more nodes. And so you have a relationship between the node and the other. Mm-hmm. So these relationships are very important. So at the first updating of time, this version updates to this version.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a rule that turns this upper left hand into this in the right next door to it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start doing that,
it's generative.
Yes, the rule generates wherever this shows up, it will generate this.
Mm-hmm.
So the first sequence of updating events, if you use this as your rule, is this set down here, right here, in mm-hmm. the, right mm-hmm. below that. And there are different ways that the events can update depending on which set of this appears in order to change to this. So it's kind of dependent on the location and the way that they're relating.
Oh, nice.
But by the time you get down, keep following down below, this thing here, after many updates, turns into something that looks like this.
And that looks like neural networking in the brain.
Or like the universe, basically.
Yeah.
But this would be very small, but it's going to keep growing. It keeps growing. So then mm-hmm. he looks at it from a multiple different perspectives. So here in the middle, he's looking at the initial condition of the very first movement. And then if you look at this as all the different potential coming out of that initial movement, and at any point in time, you take a slice across there, you're going to see where the universe is at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
So he shows how these relationships can result in certain nodes that then become generative on their own. And the interesting thing that happens is some of these nodes begin generating, but then over time they come back together again. So this one and this one would come back together again. So things can divide and spread out, but then they can also come back together again.
This is fascinating. This is very, very interesting. Where does it impact us? How does it affect me talking to you, or does it?
Well, as they've been working on this now for about 5 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, as he's worked on this from all these different perspectives, he's come up with, he's actually proven many of the laws of physics using this setup.
Ah, okay. So it's been tested in the field.
Well, he would say so. I mean, a lot of physicists don't agree with him at all. But
right.
what it does for me is, even if he's completely wrong, it's a very interesting concept to think of time as the updater of events.
Mm-hmm.
And let me show you one more screen from there. Let's see. I lost that now. Well, I shouldn't have done that. Sorry about that. Yeah, so now I'm kind of messed up. So now you see my whole screen, right?
Yes.
And let's see, I got a whole bunch of junk on here. I knew I couldn't have done that. Yeah, hopeless. I'm hopeless. I am totally hopeless. I'll start doing some work while we're doing this. Yeah, I can't even get back to the original screen. I think it must have.
Okay.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
There we go.
I was going to look at another page from this website.
Are there implications that if he's right and this new way of looking at the generation of the cosmos, are there any kind of implications that he makes prognoses about?
Oh, he's written thousands of pages on this.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, when he started thinking about it, he thought about there being just one rule.
Mm-hmm. But
over time, he didn't like the implications of that one rule. And so he decided that he decided that instead of just it being one rule, that it could be every possible rule being followed at every possible moment. So if you think of it that way, he calls that structure, the structure of all possible rules, updating to all possible changes at all possible times. He calls that structure the ruliad. And
That sounds very
ruliad can
mystical.
look like these things here. You can see some of these structures that arise, and they begin to look very lifelike. You can see from these visual galleries that there's a lot of structures that begin to look biological, or you can see chemical elements developing and all that kind of stuff. But the reason I brought it up is that you used the word hyper. And so he talks about the ruliad being this structure of all these possible changes. And then one of the guys that he's working with said, well, in order for things to hold together, there has to be a ruliad above the ruliad. There has to be a hyper ruliad. And then he said, of course, there would have to be a hyper hyper ruliad above the hyper ruliad. And then he got into this, infinite regression thing, because he apparently doesn't believe that there can be some place that is a place of unchanging generative power. I believe in a place of unchanging generative power, unchanging in the sense that always generative, always good, always quality, that kind of unchanging. Not unchanging in the sense of being static, but
Right,
unchanging
you're
in
talking
the
an ultimate force.
well,
That
and
would
see,
be.
that's an interesting question, because to me, the problem with saying force is that if it's a force, then I can tap into that force. And I can tap into that force and use it for my own benefit. But if I recognize it's not a force, but a person, then I can't use him for my own purposes. I just have to receive. And
But you could, I mean, as much as I think I'd stick with the word force, I can understand you coming from your Christian background thinking of a person. But even if we're talking about Christ and Christ consciousness, you would still be in relationship with it or with him.
Yes, well, the relationship with him is the key.
And that when John Vervaeke starts talking about transjective, that just opens up so many avenues of understanding for me. And I think he coined the term for when
I
he
think he
would.
probably did. I mean, there have been a lot of people who have thought about that relational aspect. There's a famous physicist named Carlo Rovelli who says that everything is relationship. If you go down to the bare substance of the universe, it's all relationship. Well, that's a lovely picture. I like that. But, he would also say that there's no ultimate being or ultimate person, but relationship is certainly fundamental aspect of the universe or the cosmos. I think it has to be. But I don't know if you've ever read any Barfield. Owen Barfield talked a
I
lot about
haven't. He's someone who, I've been a full-time massage therapist for many years, and I worked at gyms. And when I wasn't doing massage, my nose was in a book, so I could be reading two, three, four books a month. And I pretty much retired from that world. And now, since I've been watching so many YouTube videos that are so stimulating, my reading habits have significantly changed. And
Me too, me too. Yeah, it's really sad.
Now I'm reading the same book two and three times and taking two and three times longer to read them, because
my tunneling into what is being said is becoming so much more profound.
Yes, that's cool. I like that.
Yeah, so I just recently bought, I don't know, like maybe 10 or a dozen books after a couple of years of, trying to get a handle on what I've been reading. And a lot of it is religion and mysticism and philosophy. And Barfield is someone who I want to read. I definitely do, eventually. But, like there's, I've watched John's Awakening from the Meaning Crisis. It's 50 hours. I'd maybe put in 500 hours watching it to really,
oh,
really
wow.
try. Yeah, it was transformative. And then I watched his The Elusive Eye with Greg Enriquez quite a few times, and the one on consciousness, I forget the name of. I'm waiting to start after Socrates until I have the time to do the reading that is suggested while you watch it, so I can participate fully in it. But that might be 2 years down the road. I don't know. But I've come to the point now where being with who I am at the moment now is essential, and honoring that. So when it happens, it happens. And being in the moment is the lesson that is it for me now. And my art is about unfolding that. So,
well, would you like to show some of your art?
Okay. I have some stuff. I'm not sure. Tell me how. Why don't you turn it off, and I'll show you the art and see if you think that will look any okay on from you screening it.
Oh, so that we can determine how best to do this.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll
yeah.
put us on pause here. So now we're looking at your website, and this is one of your pieces.
This was done around 2019. Astral Rush, I think is what it's called. Before you let me bring up the paintings that I was doing in the 80s, The Gift of the Universe. Let's see, I don't want to overwhelm you. So this, let's see if I can, yeah, how's that?
Yeah, I can see it.
This was called Hubble's Waltz. And in the 70s and 80s, I was reading every layman's book on quantum physics and relativity theory and astrophysics, and along with Wilbur and his levels of consciousness, and a little bit of the books of early psychology, Freud, Jung. The reason for all of that reading was I got out of college and I realized that the two major strands of 20th century thought, science and psychology, I knew zip about. So much for college education.
Yeah.
So I absorbed all of this stuff, and Gary Zukav's book, Dancing Woolly Masters, like a switch just kind of like clicked. And I was able to start to really imagine these kind of, again, these cosmic spaces. And these were always meant to be very, very playful and poetic. And in a certain sense, the viewer completes them because they are different layers of different ways of putting paint down and investigating spatially. They need a viewer to see the multiple layers all at one time and yet individually, and kind of get very trippy with them.
So those paintings, these were, I didn't realize it at the time. I remember thinking that I live in, New York City, and I wanted to paint pictures that had the visual complexities of walking down the street on a busy street in New York. So there was this sense of embracing complexity. But as I now look back at them, I also know that they're very much about generating a kind of expanded consciousness. Talk about that transcendence again. Looking at them is very much, they're not easy paintings to look at because you have to really focus and explore them. But they're very expansive and contractive and expansive. There's like so much direction going on in different ways. And the artist who I was, I think, communicating with while I was painting these 7 years of paintings were Matisse. I remember thinking, oh, I want to out Matisse Matisse. Matisse is like the artist who gave color to the 20th century, and I wanted to participate in that adventure, that color adventure. And then there's Picasso with analytical cubism and how he fractures space. And then there's Pollock. And I remember reading somebody who said something very interesting about Pollock. Pollock's great drip pour paintings, there are these large scale movements, and then there's the very tiny. But the in between, the middle ground, there's nothing there. It's either small or large. And I was talking to Pollock especially in these, but I was saying, here's the solution to that problem. Here's middle ground as well. You give me that expansive space, but here's stuff going on in the middle. So that was my 7 years of playing around with this stuff, and I thought I was going to be doing it for the rest of my life. Because I thought this is my mind to just it's going to give me my life journey. And eventually I just learned what I had to learn from and got tired. And then started painting intuitively, and then came to meditation, and eventually got to stuff like this. This was 2004 to 2008. I used this exact composition over and over and over again, just changing the color relationships and maybe the edginess, the thickness of the vertical lines, and they were all about meditation. They were all about the openness and the spaciousness that you can get from meditating. And stop them. What happened? Oh, I have a decline. There we go. Sorry. While I was doing these and I had no end in sight for the still point paintings, I was on vacation in New Mexico, Albuquerque. And got a phone call that my mother had died. And when I came back, I went into the studio and then for 5 years processed the grief from her passing. And this was one of the first paintings that I painted. Yeah, this was the first one. And then they got less and less difficult and tragic, and they led to these paintings. What should I do here? And these led to, like, the first picture that you saw, the which I called my waking up paintings, which started before I saw John Vervaeke's stuff, but really got amped up. Interestingly, when these began to happen, these the new chapter, the ones I just showed you before, and this, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, 2016, and I'm okay. I through my partner Marion, I got to go to a naturopath as part of my healing, and he got me to change my diet, to really get on a good supplement program, and to exercise. And we didn't talk about this, but I'm bipolar. And when I did these three things, the side effects from my medication disappeared, and my awareness started to really wake up in ways that it hadn't before.
Well, that's terrific to hear. Wow.
The way the universe unfolds is a mystery to me, a total mystery. And I had some very, 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 very dark days in the 70s. And to be where I am now, with all the love of friends and family and the opportunities I've had as an artist, I feel blessed, and I feel like there's a kind of grace that I'm connected to. But I'm humbled by the whole thing.
Well, so let's talk about that a little bit. So you said that you've had all these opportunities as an artist. Could you talk about that a little bit?
I'm in a spiritual community with a guru, and one of the people who I've befriended was in a gallery in New Mexico, and the New Mexico dealer moved to Harlem. And my acquaintance said, "You should look at this guy's art." And he went on to Instagram, which I had just gone on to because another friend had embarrassed me into not being on Instagram. And I got a call from him and said, "I want to show you."
Oh, wow.
So I've showed with him three times, twice in Harlem and once in Chelsea. And Chelsea is like the heart of the art world in the whole world. So to have had that opportunity, when I was in junior high school, I remember thinking, if I could be, my plan for my life was to become a high school art teacher, and maybe I would paint a little painting that I might be proud of one day. And to have created a body of work that echoes deeply my experience, and the power that it communicates with has so far
transcended anything I had any inkling that I would be doing. It's like it just, yeah, tiny steps, tiny decisions, go do this place, next. I live in a loft that I had a psychotic episode back in 1978 or so, and I was going back to Hunter College to get a degree to teach art, and I went to the 16th floor, which was the art department, and I saw a notice saying studio available. Now, I was living with my parents. I had no friends. I was like the third rail for everything that we went on. I didn't say a word to anybody. And I was painting some stuff in a little storefront. And I opened up into this studio experience that has transformed my life entirely. That the entire, from 1983 on, my work is so dependent upon the fact that I have come to this studio. And I got it because I was looking to become a history art teacher in college again. And I don't know how the, you know, how things happen, but there's been so much in my life that is chance that I've made good on, that built on all this bad time. I mean, like, in the 70s, I was in and out of mental institutions. I was in prisons. I was homeless. There were suicide attempts. Yeah, the depths of the darkness that I was in is so far other than who I've become, and the kind of light that I've infused into my painting is just hard for me to comprehend.
Yeah, I mean, it's I understand why you use the word grace.
Yeah, that's the only, I can't explain it any other way. I mean, it didn't happen because I willed it. Just didn't. Mm-hmm.
Well, in all the books that you've read, have you happened upon Maps of Meaning by Jordan Peterson?
I'm reading it now because you talked about it.
Well, chapter 4 about anomaly.
I'm not there yet. Okay, I'm not there yet.
When you get there, I think that's your story.
I actually brought it with me to read from page 99. There are two paragraphs that are outstanding, if you'd like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love bouncing off ideas about any paragraph from Maps of Meaning.
Okay, here we go. No matter where an individual lives, and no matter when, he faces the same set of problems, or perhaps the same set of meta problems, since the details differ endlessly. He is a cultural creature and must come to terms with the existence of that culture. He must master the domain of the known, explored territory, which is the set of interpretations and behavioral schemas he shares with his societal compatriots. He must understand his role within that culture, a role defined by the necessity of preservation, maintenance, transmission of tradition, as well as by capacity for revolution and radical update of that tradition. When such update becomes necessary, he must also be able to tolerate and even benefit from the existence of the transcendental unknown, unexplored territory, which is the aspect of experience that cannot be addressed with mere application of memorized and habitual procedures. Finally, he must adapt to the presence of himself, must face the endlessly tragic problem of the knower, the exploratory process, the limited mortal subject, must serve as eternal mediator between the creative and destructive underworld of the unknown and the secure, oppressive, patriarchal kingdom of human culture. I just love that.
Yeah, one of the things I wrote in the margin there is the patriarchal kingdom is oppressive because we know what perfect looks like. And perfect is unachievable. So if we are put under the rubric of having to achieve perfection, then the patriarchy becomes absolutely oppressive. But if instead of seeing the perfection as something that we need to achieve, if we see the opportunity to grow within the, let's say, family of this benevolent, loving ruler, father figure, then all the opportunities open up in front of us. And then you have, if you see it as grace rather than as oppression, then all these opportunities open up and the world just unfolds in front of you. And I think of that a lot because for much of my early life, I lived under that oppressive rule of myself that I need to achieve perfection. And kind of the only way that I was able to escape as a young person from that was to become a serial procrastinator. Because if you procrastinate long enough, then you have a good excuse for not achieving perfection. You get it done, but you had to get it done really fast. So if it's not perfect, it's okay. That was my way out when I was a young person.
I have to say I don't understand that frame of mind, but that's okay.
Well, you know, because I think you started out as a much more open and kind of artistic person, where I started out as a much more left brain analytical kind of a person, even when I was a young person. And then I became more open and artistic when I actually started doing art. That's what really opened my brain up to this more expansive view of the world. But yeah, that's a great paragraph.
I found Matt Siegel. Do you know Matthew Siegel?
Yeah, he's been on my channel a couple of times.
Okay, so he
and a great conversation between him and Michael Levin on my channel.
Oh, I'll have to look for it. He had this one phrase in the talk that I listened to, penetrating the infinitely deepening mystery of existence.
Okay, so what did that say to you?
That's what I'm doing. That's what my art is doing. That's my journey as an artist. It's not about making something beautiful. It's making something that gets deeper and deeper and deeper in touch with something in myself that hopefully is a reflection of something that's universal.
So can I ask you a technical question?
Sure.
I notice you get these kind of misty color field backgrounds, and these are very large works. So how do you achieve that? What tools do you use to get the paint spread on the background?
That comes back to when I told you when I worked for that contractor in 1968, 69 and sprayed with an industrial paint sprayer sealing plywood.
Okay.
I bought myself an industrial paint sprayer. And the backgrounds are industrial sprayed. The bottom with the mist is sprayed. The discs are marked out. They're sprayed. And the painting that I have up at the moment, Astral Ping, the colors that are dripped down are really thick, viscous paint.
If I'm in the room with this painting, then and I'm looking at it, I'm going to see the difference in not only the color and the application, but also the thickness,
yes,
and the texture of the paint.
Yes, yes. It's not like when you look at a Van Gogh and you see the ridges and the real thickness, but there is a layer of difference between the thinness of the sprayed backgrounds and the opacity and the substance of the drips. And actually, I think that's evolved too. I think they've gotten more. They've got at times they get thicker, at times they're not so thick. Let me see if I can find any.
One more technical question.
Okay.
Helen Frankenthaler used to paint on unfinished canvas.
Unprimed canvas.
Ungesso, unprimed, yeah. Now, do you do that or do you prime it first?
I prime it. Yeah.
Okay.
I want there to be a resilient surface. Yeah. What do I want to show you? Here we go. So what's going on in this one, if you can see it, is that the background is getting more pebbly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where I'm evolving with the surfaces of the spray so that they're much more granular and visually full of information that you can actually see, but you almost get overwhelmed by it.
Mm-hmm.
This particular painting was a response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and my growing understanding of how human beings make war with each other, and there are ideas that happen, but the wars seem to be the constant. And I titled this for Joan Baez, With God on Our Side, for two reasons. One, Joan Baez had this beautiful voice. So this is, I think, an elegant painting. But the lyrics to With God on Our Side is a Bob Dylan lyric about how everybody fights a war and everybody on either side always thinks that God is on their side.
Mm-hmm.
So this was kind of like, here we are again. And it's a reflection of the beautiful sound of Joan Baez. And yet it's that disc of dark malevolence that seems to be part of how we react to each other. So
what do you make of that? What do you do?
I read a wonderful
with that darkness.
Well, I create with it. You know, and I create with that, and I create with this as well. So it's not like I'm enveloped by the tragic, profound failures that have been consistent throughout our recorded history, because there have been enormous successes as well. I read a wonderful, wonderful book by James Hillman, which was his last book. It was called A Terrible Love of War. And it's four chapters. And he uses his post-Jungian perspective on talking about how in the first chapter, war is always going on. There have been thousands of wars in our history. It's normal. It's not like, you know, wars happen. We're human beings. Wars happen. It's part of, evidently, it's part of just who we are as humans. The second chapter is about how inhuman things can happen during wars.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's like wars give us permission to be the worst possible people we can be. Never, and it doesn't matter whose side you're on. You whether it's the My Lai massacre or the Auschwitz death camps, you know, good people do terrible things in wars.
The third chapter is on the sublimity of war. There's a kind of camaraderie that soldiers have with each other, where they come out of wars and they say, that was the most intense, incredible live time in my entire life. And then you have a movie like Apocalypse Now, where it's just, you know, the horror of the war is like, it's spectacular. It's just so sublime in all its horror. And then the last chapter is on how wars are fought for religious reasons, or religious reasons are used to buttress wars. So, you know, I've read the book twice, and it's helped me get a handle on what we do. And you know, I watch the news now, and I just see the pornography of devastation. And you know, some people have good reasons for it, some people don't, but it's ultimately insane.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I know about insanity, so you know, from a personal, you know, from being there and living it. So, you know, I have a leg up on a lot of people because I've lived through something that a lot of people really fear. I've experienced that. So I know in my core about insanity and irrationality. And when I watch that stuff on the news, there it is. There it is.
So when he wrote this book, did he delve at all into all the various aspects of each of those points in each chapter?
Yes, he filled them out. Yes, very poetically, but with mostly with Greco-Roman mythology. That was his handle.
Because I mean, it feels like there's what you gave is a very clear summary, but it feels like there's some holes there that show another side of humanity.
Oh, he's not addressing that, and he's not saying that isn't true. He's not saying that's all there is.
Okay.
No. He's not. No. He's just trying to illuminate this specific human activity.
Well, no, but I mean, even in war, even in the sublimity of war, where you think about the camaraderie between warriors, it's not all camaraderie to do horrible things together. Some of that camaraderie is actually based on a willingness to sacrifice yourself for the good of other people. And
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There, my thinking on that is that there's, it seems to have been a very masculine thing, although there are women soldiers now too. But the idea that when we're young men, it's like that the Native American testing of the young man in battle. You know, it seems to be like a psychological growth point that a man needs to go through to confront death and test himself and see his, it's even Hemingway-esque, you know, that grace under pressure, that sense of the ultimate confrontation with who you are as a human being. I think we're a lot more complex than that, but I think in our teens and 20s, that's like for men, and I was that was never me, but I think for a lot of men, that's a key growth point to face death.
and come out on the other side.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a lot of that comes out in Maps of Meaning as well.
Oh, good. I
Which
look forward.
Has been many times people try to simplify it, simplify it as the hero's journey, you know, and, you know, it's there's a pattern to the hero's journey and this is that and all that. But I mean, I think the reality is that this whole idea of falling into chaos or voluntarily entering chaos are two different things in terms of how they affect our capacity to move forward. But even falling into chaos can have the result of, if while you're in the chaos, you look around and try to discover why you might be there, as Solzhenitsyn did, or what there is there that you can gather together and bring back with you when you come out of the chaos. And that sounds to me like that is part of at least what happened to you when you were dealing
Yes.
with the mental challenges in the 70s.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so I think war can be something like that too, where
yes,
for some of the men or women who get involved in the dark side and let their dark side come out, or maybe even they don't let it come out, but they come aware of their dark side when they're in the middle of war, they can never recover from that. I mean, Peterson talks about that all the time, about people who part of the reason they have such severe PTSD is that while they're in the midst of some battle, they become aware of their own capacity to do severe evil in that situation. And they never knew that was in themselves. They never knew that dark side existed. And so they can't face it. So they
that
can't
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, they can't come back out of it. But which is why he encourages people voluntarily to look at your capacity for darkness, because then you can help incorporate that into your, into the wholeness of who you are, recognize, you know, and I mean, from my side, recognize it and repent of it and allow that to be transformed. And sometimes that can be transformed. You know how every good aspect has a, has the backside of the page has the negative aspect. So some people may be strong-willed, which makes them difficult to deal with. But the other side of that is that they have a great capacity to accomplish things because they can push through things, you know? So every good aspect of us has its backside, and to recognize that backside and not be afraid of it, but to allow it to be transformed. I think that's the whole thing that Verveke's talking about with the transjective relationship between communicators. Because in the midst of any conversation, this difficulty can arise, but between the two people, they can find the positive side of that and grow from it. So all these things are relationship. They go all the way down. This is beautiful. I really like this one, by the way.
This is called The Fire Within.
Uh-huh.
And it's taken from the title of a book by a fairly well-known, it's a memoir by this well-known psychologist who dealt with bipolar, who is bipolar. So this was my reflection on that, am bipolar, and this was like my poetic visual representation of like the fire of it and coming through it and the transcendence.
So when I look at the red circle in the center and the title, The Fire Within, is that implication that the center there, because it's bounded, it's a bounded circle, it's a bounded sphere, and the bounded sphere isn't leaking out into the rest of the image. So is the implication that the fire within is held within a boundary?
Let me think about that.
I think the circle, the disc, may be a metaphor for self, consciousness, in a field of consciousness, with the gently sprayed red on the horizontal at the bottom being a grounding in feeling. I think that's maybe the way I would talk about this. But the fact that it's basically a two-color composition, it's the red and the orange, yellow, and the red on the bottom is the same color as the disc. That has to do with my love of Matisse again, and like how I've been creating dynamic visual color experiences that have a kind of simplicity that you see immediately, but that hopefully will draw you in to an extended viewing. One of the things we didn't talk about with my art that I look for in other artists and always enjoy is there's a, and you talked about this a little with your, you were left brain and then you kind of got into art and developed your right brain. Verveke talks about rationality as not being procedural. I'm not thinking of the right word. Wait, he's talking about rationality as translogical. It's more than just A equals A plus B equals AB. I mean, it's more than that. From looking at my body of work, there is a kind of compositional and color rationality that permeates it. There is often real dialogue between different parts of a painting, even though they're set up so simply. But that's very conceptually graspable through looking at it, which seems to be something that is not what I see a lot in other art. Maybe I'm just missing it, and maybe it's because I'm doing it, I see it, but it's something that I see very, very clearly in my own work. And even in these wild, joyous, celebratory paintings, I see I, there there's a connection to the repetition of patterns, the color dynamics, the that all have a kind of visual coherence. And I think how I understand that, and when I was an adolescent and a teenager, a friend of mine, we there was a group of us that hung out. I lived who lived around the corner from me, and this young kid had a his parents had a regulation size pool table built into their basement, and a group of us would always go down and play pool. Now, I was very bad at the long shots, but when there was a congestion, if you'd break the triangle of balls up, oftentimes there'd be like a congestion of balls near the bottom. I consistently was able to understand which ball to hit to have like a four or five chain reaction so that the end ball would go into the corner pocket. And I did that intuitively. In yeah, I just kind of like I conceptualized it. Now, me with numbers, mathematically, I'm terrible, but my conceptual space, is something that I see in these paintings. That capability is like something I translated into these very, very information dense paintings.
Well, there's such a wide difference between the work that you did in the 80s and the work you're doing now.
And the work I did in the 80s came from all that reading of science and science fiction. And then the work now is from, it's like 1991 on, the meditation. The ground, but it's about consciousness. There's that through line. Even though these are like wild sybaritic expressions of celebration, they're about consciousness. So I got rid of, I just kind of like calmed everything down and got grounded. And I said, well, what's there now?
In terms of the painting process, would you say that you enjoy the process as much now as you did when you were doing what you call the celebratory paintings?
That's a very interesting question. That's a very interesting question. Well, when I painted the grief and after pictures, I was very conscious that putting the paint on the canvas and letting it drip down was a very cathartic experience. The actual doing of that was unleashing me being able to grieve for my mother. And the interesting thing is that I only did that. I only grieved in the studio. It wasn't like it bled out to the rest of my world. When I was in the studio, I could be the grieving son. And I did those paintings for 5 years.
Well, it definitely takes a long time to move through a grief like that, for sure.
And I like to think my mother would be is someplace really enjoying who I become. Here we go. So these were done when I had a little storefront and I started painting again in 1980. After I had been working with my father. He had a small little greeting card store in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, and my life was like absolutely empty. And my mother said, "Let's get him to start painting again." And I started doing these in this little storefront. And again, it's processed with dripping, but they were about putting my life together again. They were joining, they were building, they were structuring. Again, that coherence in the but I you know, there were a lot of
So in a sense, you have certain stylistic moves that you make that have been consistent throughout your career.
I could even call them a bag of tricks, although they're not tricks. But yes, there are go-to things that I've been playing with. And I think the word to pay attention to is play. Because when I go into the studio, it's not about making something beautiful. It's about growing and playing and challenging myself.
Well, because I mean, I really do think that art, the process of art making is basically identical to the process of what it takes to live a life. It's the same. I mean, if you simplify it way down, it is exactly the same process that you're going through. Because
Years ago, I said to myself, I remember saying that if I could be as healthy as I am in the studio in the rest of my life, that would really be an accomplishment.
so in a
And
sense, the artwork was kind of helping to rewire you.
oh, absolutely, absolutely. John Ravecki talks about an anagogic, the anagogic journey, going from the Plato's cave and going outside and being illuminated and changing and then being illuminated and changing. And then, and I look at my painting as totally anagogic. I make things, I ingest the object after I've made it and then change. And it's, I've talked about it someplace else is like building a ladder that you're climbing while you're building it.
Yes. Yes, I can see that. I like that picture of ingesting the object after creating it and then changing. Because I mean that's also a true picture of anything that we ingest. What we ingest changes us. So it doesn't have to be, it can be some natural thing that we come across that we incorporate into ourselves and it changes us. And that seems to be a picture of something that's at the very essence of the universe as well, that whole
I
process.
agree. I agree. George
Well,
Steiner.
so we're at an hour and 40 minutes or something like that right now. So is there something that you would like to say to kind of wrap up and
One last thing.
okay.
George Steiner wrote an absolutely stunning book called Real Presences. It's 1989, and it's a book on aesthetics. And in it, there's just this lovely, lovely sentence where he says that the otherness that enters us makes us other.
Oh, yeah, that's a great statement. It reminds me of that. There's another quote that's very similar to that. Like, I drew a circle and the circle was too small to fit somehow. And then the idea is that you draw a bigger circle and it takes in the other. So there's the little circle that's only big enough for me, so somehow I have to draw a bigger circle that's for the other. Somebody will get in the comments and tell me who said that and how it was said much more eloquently in the original.
Well, this has been wonderful.
It's been a very wonderful experience, Lester. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us and your life story and to have grappled with bipolar and found a way to use that to bring beauty to the world, I think is very remarkable. So I thank you for sharing your story with us, and maybe we can talk again someday.
I would love that. I would love that.
Maybe after you finish chapter 4 of Maps of Meaning.
Well, I think I'm close to beginning it, so
Cool.
yes.
Very good. Well, have a wonderful week and we'll talk to you again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.